Welcome back to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price. I'm joined by Chad Bird. As always, Chad, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm good, man.
Where are we at? We're in Exodus 4, right?
And we're somewhere
halfway
in Exodus.
Through, something like that. I think we sort of left off in the middle of something last time. Little encounter that Moses had with God on the way back to Egypt, something like that.
Yeah, his wife left something on his feet and whole thing.
right. So I guess we gotta finish that and see what happens next. This is gonna be one of those everything seems to be going well kind of stories, and then there's one of these plot twists. So got some good stuff coming up.
Story of my life, man.
Yeah. I think that's pretty much the story of all of our lives. Ups and downs, back and forth, right? I think we are about at chapter 4, verse 25, 26. We have Moses heading back to Egypt, and the Lord meets him on his way and tries to put him to death. We went into that at the very end of the 40 minutes last time. And I think I want to pick up and talk about for just a minute that I don't think we got to last time is this whole idea of the firstborn, which I think is part of this story as well. This is the son of Moses, and he's not circumcised, and so Zipporah, Moses' wife, she circumcises their son, and she touches Moses with this blood from the circumcision, with a bloody foreskin, and says, "You're a bridegroom of blood to me." And thus Moses is saved by the blood of his son that was shed in the circumcision. And I did mention last time that this is connected by means of a certain Hebrew verb with the Passover itself, because here the blood is touched to Moses, and that same verb is used in Exodus 12, a few chapters later, to describe how the blood of the sacrifice is to touch. We usually say placed or painted or something like that, but the Hebrew verb is touched to the doors, the doorways, and the doorposts and the lintels of their homes. And by means of that blood, the firstborn of Israel are spared. So you kind of got that same thing going on here with the firstborn of Moses, and then the firstborn of the Israelites being spared. And immediately after the Passover, you have several verses that talk about how the firstborn belong to God. So that's kind of the part of the backstory of this story. The firstborn end up becoming very significant in the life of Israel. The firstborn of animals, which are sacrificable, is that firstborn is given over to the Lord, and they are sacrificed. They belong to Him. And then if you have an animal that can't be sacrificed, it's either killed or something is substituted in its place. And then you have the firstborn of the Israelites, who also belong to the Lord. And a special sacrifice is offered to redeem them. So you have throughout the Old Testament, both of man and beast, this idea that the firstborn is the Lord's possession, His special property. And they are redeemed by means of blood. And this begins in the Passover itself, where the firstborn of the Israelites are redeemed. And then, to jump ahead and to really understand what the firstborn is ultimately all about, you have the firstborn son of the Father, Christ Himself, who comes in order to redeem us. And so He gives His own life as the Passover victim, as the Passover lamb, as the firstborn son, in order that we might be saved by his blood. As way back in Exodus, Moses himself was saved by the blood that his own son shed in his circumcision. So if you kind of see how all these things fit together with the son and the blood and the salvation, all of this pulls together to give us in this real small story, this very short three verse story, kind of an insight into the broader way in which this has ramifications for our understanding of how God is at work and how he saves us even now by means of the blood of his firstborn.
I think that's as good as that can be explained, Chad.
Well done. Probably much more that can be said, but we'll leave it there.
I'm not sure that there is much more that can be said.
Well, you know, this is one of those passages that, as I mentioned last time, that leaves us with still lots of questions, but we don't have the answers. We can ask all the questions we want and not get any further. So let's go on. The chapter ends with a section that's 27 through 31. And this is where Aaron and Moses meet, the two brothers, and then it kind of takes us from there down into Egypt. So this is an interesting passage because this is actually something the Bible does quite a bit. It'll almost kind of provide I don't want to call it a feel-good section, but there's a section where it's almost as if you get the impression that everything is going to go well. And it's really setting you up for what's to happen later, because it's almost like every time that you have a section like this where you get the impression that everything's going to kind of come together, everybody's going to get along, everybody's going to believe and be faithful, and everything just going to kind of work out. Like whenever you come across a section like that in the Bible, just wait. Because you're almost guaranteed that what's going to happen next is going to prove that everything was not as good as it seemed. So what happens is that God appears to Aaron, journeys into the wilderness to meet Moses, his brother, and presumably they haven't seen each other for 40 years, unless there's some get together, some reunion between his departure from Egypt and this that we're not told about. And they meet significantly at the mountain of God. This is where God appeared to Moses and commissioned him to go into Egypt. And there, Moses basically tells his brother everything that went down at the mountain. So he tells him all the things that God told him, and he showed him all the signs that God commanded him. You remember that Aaron is Aaron's kind of part of this team ministry, if you will, because Moses kept making excuses, saying he couldn't do this and he couldn't do that and he couldn't speak well, and why don't you send somebody else? And so finally God lost his cool with Aaron, with Moses, and said, all right, then we'll bring your brother Aaron along for the ride. So Aaron's going to be part of this all the way. In fact, Aaron will kind of be the co-leader with Moses, really, until they get back to Mount Sinai, and then all hell breaks loose when Aaron decides to make a golden calf, which will be a few chapters down the road. So Moses and Aaron, they make the journey together. They go down into Egypt, and they gather together all the elders of Israel, the leadership, political and social and religious leadership of the Israelites. And just like Moses told Aaron everything that God had told him, and just like Moses showed Aaron all the signs that God had given to him, so Aaron and Moses now turn around and do the same thing for the people. So they speak all the words, they perform all the signs. I'm guessing they threw the rod down and became a snake. And maybe Moses did the whole leprosy and then cleanse of leprosy miracle. Anyway, everything they were told and everything they were given, they spoke and they did. And here's the result. This is how chapter 4 concludes. It says, so the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshiped. So you got faith and you got worship hand in hand after they hear all these words from God and after they see the signs. So this is kind of the, this is sort of that, you know, initial phase of hearing the good word, of becoming aware that God cares about them, that he's come to see them. He sent Moses and Aaron in order to help them and to redeem them. So, and it's kind of like the parable of the soils that Jesus told, you know, upon that some of it falls on shallow soil, and upon hearing the word, they receive it with joy, right? But just because the word is received with joy at the beginning, does not necessarily mean that joy is going to follow, as we'll hear in the next chapter. But you know, this is very typical of all of us. I mean, this is humanity displayed with the Israelites serving as our surrogates. You know, it's easy to believe when basically everything is going well, or that you think everything is going to go well, that you finally are on the point of everything kind of working out. And that's where the Israelites were. What they didn't realize was that, you know, God wasn't going to simply show up in Egypt and wave his magic wand, and all of their problems and all of the evil and all of the slavery was going to go away. Any time that God begins to act, he is going to meet with resistance from evil. And because God works through people and through ordinary means, then there's always going to be the possibility of rejection and of rebellion. And sometimes, in order for evil to be overcome, more evil results. That's just the nature of our fallen world. Yeah, and so that's what the Israelites are about to experience.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you got the old sorrow may tarry for the night, but, you know, joy comes in the morning, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. I think that joy may come in the morning, but sorrow comes in the night is also true. It seems that days are cyclical like that. And so it's not as though, like, hey, man, I mean, we tend to think that, like, all right, we get through this night.
We got right?
Yeah, day. It's like, yeah, followed by night. Like, again, like, and this is how life works. The day does not last forever. Not until that final day, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I think the longer we live, and the more we study the biblical story itself, so the more we see our own lives, the more we see the story of the lives of people in the scriptures, the more we're made aware of that, and the less shocked we are when that next night comes, because we know that morning will follow, and then that'll be followed by another night, and that this is the pattern of life. There's always going to be ups and downs and crosses, Good Fridays and Easters, but I mean, the good news that we also begin to realize more and more is that despite this inconsistency of our situation in life, there is consistency of God's faithfulness to us through it all. And I think we also begin to learn the various ways in which we receive the blessings of God, whether the sun is shining or whether midnight is upon us. Because we begin to see that in the good times, there is much for which to be thankful, and that God is blessing us and is giving us all the gifts of his grace. But then we also, when those dark times come and when we bear the cross, we also realize that sometimes what's happening is that God is stripping away from us our idols and drawing us close to himself and assuring us that the one thing needful will never be taken from us, which is his love and his mercy. So, you know, that is the way that God works, whether it's daytime or nighttime, whether it's suffering or not, in all these various situations of life, he's showing us various things about himself and ourselves, and that ultimately it doesn't matter what's happening in our lives, because our life itself, Christ itself, is unchanging.
Yeah.
So that's where the Israelites were, the same place that we often are. So Moses and Aaron, they do this, the people believe, they bow down and worship. And now we'll see what happens next. So this is the beginning of chapter 5. And here we have the first encounter with our friend Pharaoh. So Moses and Aaron, having told the people that God cares about them, make this first step toward addressing Pharaoh and telling him what they want, and more specifically what God demands from them. So they go to Pharaoh, and the first words out of their mouth are, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel," which I kind of have to laugh at, because I'm just trying to picture the scene here. You know, here's Moses, who had to flee the country 40 years earlier because of the murder that he committed, and he's there with his brother, and they approach the throne of a guy that considers himself to be the incarnation of a god, which is what the Pharaohs believe themselves to be. They believe themselves to be the incarnation of one of the gods of Egypt. So they understood, their self-understanding was that they were endowed with divine power. So you got to kind of keep that in mind. This isn't like, you know, somebody marching into the Oval Office and making demands of the President of the United States. This isn't even like someone walking to the office of a king in another country and making demands of him. These are two guys walking into the presence of a guy that considers himself to be the embodiment of a god endowed with divine power. And the first words out of their mouth are a demand, excuse me, a demand from another god, and not just a demand, but a demand that he let the people of this god go. So you can forecast what's going to happen almost from these opening words and knowing the setting. So here's what they say. They say, "Thus says the Lord," which in literally is "Thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness."
It's sneaky.
Now, you know, yeah, sneaky. Now, yeah, I think we did talk about this before. You notice the first thing they say is not, "Let my people go, that they might journey through the wilderness and enter the land that God promised to give to them." It is, at least relatively speaking, a small demand. More or less, they're asking for a chance to go and to worship the God whom they serve in a way that he, you know, desires them to serve him. So a feast, it says, that we may celebrate a feast in the wilderness. This, the Hebrew there is chag, which is always kind of like a pilgrim festival. It's a pilgrimage to a specific place where a sacrifice is offered and worship takes place. So, you know, for instance, the Passover in later years, the Passover was a chag, and Tabernacles was, and Pentecost was, because in each of these chag festivals, you traveled to Jerusalem, and there you offered sacrifices and had a feast and whatnot. So this is going to be not just some kind of celebration that takes place in Egypt, but they need to go out into the wilderness in order to celebrate it. And Pharaoh's response is this. He says, "Who is Yahweh that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I don't know Yahweh. And besides, I won't let Israel go." So Pharaoh, who sees himself as divine, is saying, I don't even know this God that you're talking about. It's not like he doesn't acknowledge his existence, because the Egyptians were polytheists. I mean, they fully believed that there were other gods, and they believed that other nations had their gods. So it's not like Pharaoh is saying, your God, Yahweh, doesn't even exist. He's saying, listen, I don't even know who he is. And even if I did, I still wouldn't let you go and celebrate this festival in the wilderness.
Yeah, I mean, you got to assume that he's also thinking like, so the God of the Hebrews, huh? He's telling me like I need to do this thing, but you've been in slavery for like a long time now. Your God is kind of weak sauce, man. I've kind of dominated you and your God. Like, I mean, like, I don't know what kind of God this is, but he doesn't seem to be.
He doesn't seem to be too powerful.
Why is he coming to me to get you guys freedom? Why is, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, there's in this sort of day, in that day and age, man, you don't like go and tell a neighboring country, our God said that you got to do this thing. Like, no, you just pray to your God, and then like you go and you just like go kill them all or something. You go take what you want or leave, you know, this sort of thing. So this sort of God of diplomacy, that approach is especially from someone in a much weaker position saying, I mean, I get it. If you're Pharaoh, we are like, like, this is a weak move, dude. Like, your God says to let you go? Really?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a fantastic point. There were no kind of, there was no sort of theological diplomacy that took place.
No.
I mean, if you wanted to prove that your God was superior to somebody else's God, then you attacked and you killed those people. And that proved it. Because basically, whoever was victorious, whoever was master, well, that proved that the God that they worshiped was more powerful, was superior. So that's just the way it works. So if you beat the Philistines, that proved that your God was more powerful than the Philistines. But if the Philistines beat you, they would think that their God was more powerful than you. So it's a different mindset that we aren't accustomed to. But it's the idea that earthly conflict, earthly warfare mirrors heavenly conflict and heavenly warfare. So that whatever people are on top, that means their God is the more powerful.
Yeah.
After that initial attempt to convince Pharaoh didn't go so well. It's almost like Moses and Aaron decide to take a step back and to approach this a little bit differently. So this second time, they say, well, instead of thus says Yahweh, they say the God of the Hebrews, which I think is interesting. They no longer use the divine name. They just say the God of the Hebrews has met with us. So he's come to us. And because of that, they say, please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to Yahweh, our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. So this is a whole new tactic here, which also doesn't work, because it's like Moses and Aaron are saying, hey, you know, we've got to do this or God's going to kill us. He's met with us, he's told us he wants us, and if we don't do this, then he's going to fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword, which again is kind of, to me, a very strange argument. If you're trying to get this all-powerful master of the Israelite people to let them go do this, then talking about how your God is going to send pestilence or the sword upon you when you are in Pharaoh's captivity, just, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be a very persuasive argument.
No, this whole thing is like, I would have, I feel like if I was one of those two guys, I'd be like, there's no way this is like, I don't know. Like, I mean, you do wonder, like, okay, is this what God, Did God tell you to say all this stuff? Or did he just say, like, go and tell them, like, you know, to let you go? And then did they concoct this line of reasoning for, like, themselves? Because there's not a good line of reasoning. I just feel like if I was there, I would have been the guy, like, poo-pooing the whole thing, being like, guys, this is not going to work. This is terrible. None of this stuff's going to work. We gotta rethink this whole plan.
Well, maybe Moses wasn't just making excuses when he talked about how he was slow of speech and slow of tongue.
Maybe this whole thing is coming across like maybe he's actually doing. He's like because the sword and the pestilence. I mean, we gotta go, like, and, you know, and Pharaoh's like sitting there just like, yeah, right. Like, I'm not doing that. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I've got the sword. Like, I am the pestilence. Like, get back to work.
Yeah, that's right. I am the sword. You worried about sword and pestilence? I'll give you something to worry about. Which is actually what happens next. So they try these two different approaches. First, basically making a demand. Well, that didn't work. And then by talking about threats that of what might befall them if they don't do it. Well, that didn't work either, because Pharaoh isn't going to be told what to do. He's not going to be frightened by what might happen to them if they don't worship God in the way that they've asked. So here's what Pharaoh decides to do. He says, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. So more or less, leave me alone and get back to work. Listen, you're my slaves. You have been for a long time. I am the incarnation of God. I don't bow to the demands of other gods, certainly not to the gods of my slaves. And so I have you as my workers. You're here to make bricks. You're here to build walls and cities and whatever else I want built. And that's what you need to be doing. So don't be talking to me about worship. Don't be talking to me about making a 3 days journey into the wilderness. Don't even be talking to me about what might happen to you if you don't do this. All I want to hear from you is work. That's the only thing that I want to hear from you is we're going to work. We're making bricks. We're building what you want us to build. But it gets worse because as it goes on, picking up here with verse 5, Pharaoh says, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors. So you want a day off or 3 days off to make this journey, or 6 days off, or however long it's going to be to make this journey into the wilderness. Well, I've got work for you to do, and you're wanting them to cease from their labors. So Pharaoh pulls a typical act of the oppressor. He throws everything back on the people, and he blames them, and he makes it even harder for them, and then blames them when they don't follow through with his demands. So here's what he does. He gathers together the taskmasters. So these would be Egyptians. Those who were in charge of the various groups of the Israelite servants. And he says, you are no longer to give the people straw to make bricks like you did before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks, which they were making previously, that's going to stay the same. You're not going to reduce that one bit. Because they're lazy. And because they're lazy, they cry out about going to sacrifice to their God. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to make the labor even worse on them. We're going to make it even heavier on them. And we're going to work them so hard that they don't pay any more attention to false words. That's the way that verse 9 ends. So this is the typical tactic of someone, whether it's a dictator or whether it's an oppressor or whether it's a manipulator or whoever it might be. This is the way they always work. They throw everything back upon the other person and make them feel like they're to blame, to shoves the guilt back on them, makes it even harder on them. So Pharaoh is basically relieving himself of any responsibility for making it hard on the people. And he's saying, listen, you've made it harder on yourselves. And I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to work you even harder. I'm going to drive you even more into the dirt in order that you're not going to pay any attention to false words, which would call you away from the labor that I want you to do.
Yeah, I feel like this Moses and Aaron's popularity is off to a bad start. You know, I think this is also a pretty shrewd, like, yeah, I don't want to sit around here and, you know, commend pharaohs or anything, but if you are if Moses comes rolling in there, and maybe some people initially are like, all right, you know, maybe they're skeptical, but they're like, they're interested, like, he's gone, this guy's back, I mean, I'm not sure, but, you know, maybe. Well, he just kind of squashes any potentiality that, like, this is the guy. He's like, oh, yeah, well, how are you going to like it when your quota of bricks stays the same, but you got to gather your own straw? That's this guy's fault. Like, now, like, I've immediately, Moses is despairing. After this, they're like, oh, yeah, that was awesome, Moses. I'm so glad you came back.
Thanks a lot.
Very sweet. I'm sure you did hear from God in a burning bush, psycho. Hey, go back to the sheep.
Yeah. That's exactly what happens as the story goes on. You know, they had to have the straw to make the bricks, and so it's not like they could just make mud bricks. The straw was an integral part of the recipe for making bricks. It held them together. And as the straw would basically decompose inside the bricks, the chemical reaction would make the bricks stronger, make them last. So it's not like they could say, all right, well, we're just going to make bricks without straw. No, they still had to have the straw. And so the people are working even harder, and they can't make the quota of bricks. And as a result of that, the foremen, who were Israelites, she had kind of this hierarchy. You had Pharaoh on top, then you had Egyptian taskmasters, then you had Israelite foremen, and then you had the Israelite, basically the low men on the totem pole, the workers. And when they didn't meet the quota of bricks, when the Israelite servants didn't meet the quota of bricks, then the foreman got beaten over it. The Israelite foreman got beaten over it by the Egyptian taskmasters. And so the Egyptian foreman, they go and they have the audience with Pharaoh, and they say, why are you treating us this way? I mean, what they're not giving us any straw, and so we can't, there's no way that we can keep up the quota of bricks that we did previously. And Pharaoh says, look, you're lazy. You're very lazy. And because of that, you're saying, hey, we want some time off so that we can go sacrifice. But I'm not going to let you do that. And because you're lazy, I'm going to make you work even harder. So that's what the foreman hear from Pharaoh. And then it just so happens that as soon as they're walking out from their meeting with Pharaoh, they run into Moses and Aaron. And you can imagine how this conversation goes. These guys have just been, they didn't get just get a tongue lashing. I mean, they were actually beaten because their people couldn't do the impossible. So they were first angry with Pharaoh, and now when they hear the real reason, they're mad at Moses and Aaron. And here's what they say to them. They say, may the Lord look upon you and judge you, because you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants. It's like you put a sword in their hand to kill us. So that's how the Egyptian foreman, I mean, that's how the Israelite foreman react to Moses and Aaron. So, yeah, you talk about popularity level plummeting. It dropped way below the surface as a result of this initial initial meeting that Pharaoh and Aaron have with Moses.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's about it, man.
Out of time. Well, I guess we'll have to pick it up there then. We'll see how Moses responds to this, because he's going to have a few words of his own to say to God. So tune in next time.
That's it. All right, guys. Thanks so much for joining us. If you haven't done this, you know, there's a couple of different events that we're doing this year. Doing two. Maybe you live in the Detroit area, because Christ Will Fast is doing a one-day event in Detroit at Faith Lutheran Church in Troy, Michigan, to be specific, right there next to Detroit. If you live in Michigan or the Detroit area, or maybe you're up in Canada and you want to come down and hang out, you should do that. You can go over to Christ Will Fast, just go to the events page, and you can click on the Detroit thing. Also, in October, the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, the Here We Still Stand conference, me and Chad will both be there, along with a ton of other people, and we're going to be eating tons of food, and there's going to be tons of music, and there's going to be tons of speakers, and the whole thing's going to be an absolute blast. That is October 19 through 21, and you can go over to herewestillstand.org, get all the information. There is not an unlimited number of tickets for that thing. I'm not positive it'll sell out, but I'm not saying it won't sell out either. I think there's a pretty good chance that it does. So you might want to, if you're interested in doing that, you might as well get in now, because it still is at a very cheap rate. And that rate will continue to go up as it gets closer. All right, guys, thanks so much for joining us. We will see you next week.